From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
I fell in love with you the first time I looked into them eyes. And you have a certain little cute way of flirting with them eyes.
She had a voice like no other. Billie Holiday had a rare power to create absolute intimacy with an audience, to convey the deepest, rawest emotion when she sang. Her story became as well known as her song, The Hard Life, Reality and Myth. She died at 44 in Harlem. This year would have been her 100th. My guest today is meditating on her music, her art, her times, her story. This hour on Point, the great Billie Holiday. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you hear when you listen to Billie Holiday? How do you describe that voice? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Philadelphia, Billie Holiday's birthplace, is John Swed, anthropologist, jazz scholar, former professor of music, and director of the Center for Jazz Studies at Columbia University. He's written acclaimed biographies of Miles Davis and Alan Lomax. His new book is Billie Holiday, The Musician and the Myth. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. John Swed, welcome to On Point. It is wonderful to have you here.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
This is just a fabulously written book. I want to compliment you on it. It was such a pleasure to read. It is not a straight-up biography. You call it a meditation. Explain, John.
Well, there are more books than you can believe written on Billie Holiday. I've counted at least 40-some and read a handful of them in other languages as well. And they get stranger and stranger as time goes on. The material seems to set people off in strange ways. The latest one is fictionalized. It actually reads better than most of the others, but they're making it up as they go. Apparently, that's a trend in France these days. So thinking about this, I had discovered a few things that weren't talked about in previous biographies. I'd found the materials had been cut out of her original autobiography.
Like what, John?
Ladies. Well, they were things that the publisher thought would lead to litigation, although there really were very few complaints. They were mainly references to stars and drug use and so forth. But at least some of the stars, like Orson Welles, didn't object to it. But they got cold feet and pulled them back. So I found things about her interaction with a Yale professor of music and famous harpsichordist Ralph Kirkpatrick. Elizabeth Bishop, daughter of the founder of the Museum of Modern Art, of course, Tallulah Bankhead, about which at least people know something about that, but not as much as she put in her book.
You're giving us names, but what are
Charles Lawton?
Are these romantic relationships?
Yes,
or with all
romantic
of these?
Mm. But Nolan Marlena Dietrich, which everyone thought was there somewhere.
You found what was cut out, but you also point to her as a myth maker herself. Are all these verifiable, or is this Billie Holiday myth making?
Always a good question. I settled on the idea that her book was a fictional autobiography, but then it occurred to me that most of them are. I mean, who's to tell you what you can say about yourself? If it's okay in a cocktail party to stand there and make up lies about yourself, or good or bad, is there something about print that makes this different? I don't know. It's a tough question, and I don't know what we expect of as her co-author, Bill Duffy, said, who's going to fact-check the President of the United States, for example, and say, well, President, you really weren't there that day, you know? He said, not me. I'm not going to do that. So there's that element. On the other hand, the Wells thing seems to be known by at least oral sources, and as recently as 4 or 5 years ago, a film was going to be made about that by the people who made Boys Don't Cry, and there's a French novel about the relationship to Orson Welles.
Let's hold the biographer for a second. I want to stick with her voice for a minute. It's so amazing. You write, Billie Holiday's voice is odd, indelibly odd, and so easy to recognize but so difficult to describe. In her early years, some called it sad, olive-toned, whiskey-hued, lazy, feline, smoky, unsentimental, weird. Here's Fine and Mellow. This is 1939.
Love will
Holiday, 1939. One of her early compositions there, Fine and Mellow. John, you really meditate on this voice. What set it apart?
It's interesting that... Well, let me go back to her first producer, John Hammond, who said not too long before he died that someone said, when you signed Bob Dylan, were there people in the business who thought that was a weird thing to do given his voice? And he said, you think there were complaints about that? You should have heard the ones about Billie Holiday. And he went into some detail. This came up again and recently when Bob Dylan gave his talk at the Grammys and he mentioned how brave Hammond had been signing him and Holiday. It's interesting to hear that from the singers themselves, just to know that someone's taking a chance on their voices. And the interesting thing, of course, is that, well, let me back up a second. She never won any major prizes with this voice. She wasn't popular, especially popular in the black community. She never won any polls.
She didn't have hits.
Major polls. And she said her favorite singer was Joe Stafford, who beat her in the polls regularly. Joe Stafford is a friend of mine described as the master of Anglo-Saxon soul. You know, a perfect voice in a way. And it's very hard to explain how a voice like this beats out those other voices so that, well, look at Louis Armstrong. These are voices that we don't normally think of as singing voices, but somehow they stick with us.
Frank Sinatra and Billie Holiday, you say, the two that still stand so tall after all these years. What do you think it is?
Well, part of it is, frankly, biography. I mean, they have stories that seem endlessly interesting and endlessly yielding up new material. They're connected, of course, historically, in that Sinatra praised her to the sky all over the place, especially her phrasing and so forth. And there's not much... You know, Holiday didn't give many interviews, and they were all very short, and she... the things that were written under her name were all designed to try to get her drug reputation lifted in some way or another. So it's hard to know what was really going on there. But Sinatra points to the fact that he actually discussed his singing with her early on, and she gave him tips about phrasing and about bending notes and so forth. And the one newspaper article I found about in L.A. had him saying to her, but you're not commercial, Billy. And, of course, that was the real deal. She wasn't commercial, and he had to deal with that. They both, however, were masters of diction, and I'd like to stress that. You always know what they're saying, no matter how much they're messing with the melody, no matter how fast it's going. You always know exactly what they're saying. Neither one of them scat for real. That's the alternative for a singer. You know, the problem is if you want to be a jazz singer or do that kind of thing is you can't do what jazz musicians do. You can't just go off and make up your own rhythm structures inside of a phrase or shoot the tune anywhere you want because the language is pulling you back. You can scat, but that's something that Billy never did. There were no nonsense lyrics thrown around. It's astonishing that she particularly makes everything perfectly clear. And certainly it was the case for Sinatra as well, and he took pride in it.
And yet she may be joking around here with musicians, but you quote her saying, I do not got a legitimate voice. This voice of mine is a mess. A cat got to know what he's doing when he plays with me. What did she mean?
It's something she does, leaving aside the quality of the voice that we hear, the variability, and there's lots of variability. A single phrase can contain a rough growl, a sweet sound, and so on. Leaving that aside, her phrasing and her rhythm, phrasing meaning just like in speaking, mm-hmm. you know, you stop and you start. Mm-hmm. But it's her sense of the placement of notes. And it's my understanding that she's breaking all the rules of speech and song when she sings. Her notes aren't, her rhythms and the pronunciation of words are not falling on the beats in the way that they should by anybody else's understanding of this. She literally is almost never hitting on the beat with the musicians or on the way the song was written, except when she wants to emphasize something or catch up, which means she's singing at a different meter. A lot of people can imitate her, Sade, Madeleine Peru, although they don't claim to be imitating her, mm-hmm. but none of them have, or Amy Winehouse, but none of them have ever gotten this rhythmic quality right, and it's astonishing. Imagine trying to sing a song and say, "Well, I'm never going to sing on the beat with the band or the way it was written."
You've got to be Billie Holiday to really get a start on that. John Swade's wonderful new book is Billie Holiday, the Musician and the Myth. Joins us today from Philadelphia. April 7th of this year would have been Billie Holiday's 100th birthday. She died at 44 years ago. You can join us this hour. How do you know Billie Holiday? Do you remember when you first really paid attention? What you heard? How the songs hit you? My Man, Lover Man Here, Gloomy Sunday, Strange Fruit. What do you hear in this great voice? What she's channeling, depicting, sharing, saying? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, talking Billie Holiday. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
That the thrill of romance can be like a heavenly dream. I go to bed with a prayer that you'll make love to me. Strange as it seems, someday we'll meet, and you'll dry all my tears. Then whisper sweet little things in my ears, hugging and a kissing. Oh, what we've been missing. Love a man, oh, where can you be? Lady sings the blues. She tells her sad, nothing to hide.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great Billie Holiday, jazz singer, cultural icon, emotional, racial touchstone in this centenary year of her birth, 100 years ago, next month in April. Behind us here from 1956, Lady Sings the Blues. Of course, the song was chosen, also the title was also the title of her 1956 autobiography. John Swade is with us, anthropologist, jazz scholar. He's written a wonderful, what he calls, meditation on the life and music of Billie Holiday. It is Billie Holiday, the Musician and the Myth. You can join us as well in this hour. What do you hear in this great voice? What she's channeling? Why does Billie Holiday stay potent in the culture when so many singers just fade out? Do you hear her now in Amy Winehouse, Madeleine Peru, Audra McDonald, Jose James, who joins us in a moment today? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. John Swade joins us from Philadelphia, Billie Holiday's birthplace. John, what about her relationship with the African-American community? How embraced, how seen as a standard bearer or not? I mean, one of her anthems, Strange Fruit, dark and difficult, about racism and lynching. Where did she sit in the mind of the African-American audience, listeners?
Good question. The audience and singer relationships are difficult. I think they're more difficult than talking about actors and their audiences. There's enormous variability in what people hear in song. I mean, Strange Fruit is in your face. There's not much you can say that you don't understand there, in spite of the fact that some people tried to say that at one point that she didn't know what she was singing, a bizarre and absurd point of view. But other songs of hers, like God Bless the Child and so on, people have embraced, and without really, frankly, understanding the words, or choosing not to, maybe I should say, much like, John Lennon's Imagine, which is not showing up at funerals and church services in spite of its line about no more religion. Mm-hmm. I hesitate to even touch the question of what audiences make of things. But Strange Fruit, which you raise, must have upset everybody, since it was presented in a pop song setting and a nightclub setting. It was on the the backside of the record was Fine and Mellow, which you just played, mm-hmm. A blues which was sounding very familiar to people who would have heard it. But Strange Fruit is a poem by a would-be poet named Abel Meeropol, who was his real name was Lewis Allen, a school teacher in New York and a leftist who was disturbed that the Congress had been, and even FDR had been passing on lynching laws and not wanting to touch them. So he wanted to bring this to the public. And Strange Fruit was recorded on a very, very small label, a Commodore, which was a collector's label, a jazz label. But everyone seemed to know about it, at least enough to have it banned in some places. And in some places, it's even banned in the movie Lady Sing the Blues, where they decide to show you Billie Holiday watching a lynching from a bus. But they cut the key lines of the song. Maybe it's easier to see than it is to hear. I don't know. I think the Glee songbook even cut it.
John, stand by. Let's hear just a little, and then we'll hear Jose James, who has a brand new version. Here's Billie Holiday, 1939, Strange Fruit.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves. At the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
You cannot get much more direct and vivid than that when it comes to racism and lynching. John Sweat, standby in Philadelphia. With us right now from New York, Jose James, contemporary jazz, blues, hip-hop artist. His tribute album is released today. It is Yesterday I Had the Blues, the music of Billie Holiday. Jose James, thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, Tom, great to be here.
Of all the artists that you could have given tribute to, you chose Billie Holiday. Why, Jose?
I think she means the most to me. You know, she's literally my first memory on this planet. You know, seeing her face, hearing her music, and in that way, she's been with me my entire life.
Triple brave to choose this song to cover. May we listen to a little bit of your tribute version of Strange Fruit? Stand by, Jose. Here's Jose James off his new album, Yesterday I Had the Blues, the music of Billie Holiday.
The bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, the scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell, burning flesh.
Jose James not ducking anything there in his tribute cover of Strange Fruit. Jose, it's very beautiful. It's very beautiful. My compliments to you. What did you feel you had to accomplish in covering this song? I mean, that's a tall order.
Well, I feel that all you really need to do is sort of tap into the feeling that people are experiencing right now. You know, there's a lot of frustration with police brutality, you know, in Ferguson and many cities around the nation. And it's just a reminder of this ever-present situation. What I did was, besides referencing Billie Holiday's version, look at the history of black music, you know, work songs, field songs, and also modern jazz of Charles Mingus, Max Roach, and John Coltrane. If you listen to a track like Africa from John Coltrane, it's a similar thing, you know.
What would you hope would be Billie Holiday's response to your tribute version here, Jose?
Well, I mean, like her, I hope to be a voice. You know, I hope to use music as a platform to make people feel things, you know, to feel the happiest happy and the saddest sad that you can feel in order to connect on an emotional level. You know, I feel like change is only really enacted from within. So I think if she was here today, I'd love to hear that she felt something while I sang.
And her phrasing, did you try and emulate it? Is that possible?
I don't think it is possible. You know, I think what I tried to emulate was her courage and her honesty. You know, she said, you know, I only sing songs I feel. I never sing a song the same way twice. You know, for me, she's like a living human tenor saxophone. You know, she's like Lester Young or Coleman Hawkins. Like, she's driving down the lane, you know, playing the changes, but with words, you know, which really sets her apart from, I think, any other artist in jazz music besides Louis Armstrong.
Jose James, out today with his new album, Yesterday I Had the Blues, the music of Billie Holiday. It's just terrific, and we're so grateful to you for joining us for a minute, Jose. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Yesterday I Had the Blues, Jose James. Here's God Bless the Child, 1956 single. Billie Holiday said she wrote God Bless the Child after an argument with her mother over money. The song was honored with the Grammy Hall of Fame Award in 1976. She sings here with Tony Scott Orchestra in this 56 recording.
Rich relations give, crust of bread and such. You can help yourself, but don't take too much. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own. That's got his own.
God Bless the Child. John Swed, you say a lot of people don't even know what it means. It seems kind of self-explanatory, that money, child who's dependent on the charity of others is in a tough spot. What might we miss?
God bless the child, in the sense that someone's got to bless the child because they're in trouble. I suppose it'd go that way. The solution to it was finding the sheet music of it, which mm-hmm. has been there all the time, that said that, has it written as God bless with an apostrophe, which would be read then as a dialectic exclusion of the ED at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And then says, goes on to say on the sheet music, a swing spiritual is based on the authentic proverb, God blessed the child, and writes it out, mm-hmm. that's got his own. But no proverb has been found like that, and there's no. At this point, there's probably no reason to keep looking. There's certainly nothing in the Bible quite like it. So, to come back, by the way, that cover of Jose James is just astonishing.
Isn't it wonderful?
And it reminds me of how many ways people can feel these things.
Yes.
But thinking back to that and connecting it to God Bless the Child. It was a little bit of a stir when Kanye West included a sample of not Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit, but Nina Simone's in one of his recent recordings in his Jesus album. But if I understand that record, he's using it to refer to abortion.
Really?
So this is what I mean about the problems of audience and reception of the songs. In a sense, why shouldn't a person hear a song different from another person? This is not exactly a Rorschach test. Yeah. We're not being graded on it.
Yeah.
We expect this to be so. This must be hell for singers. maybe they don't worry about
it any which way. Well, maybe that's what art is for. Lauren in Buffalo, New York. Lauren, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about how Billie's been an influence to me, being an artist here in Buffalo. You know, I play some folk music and sort of contemporary rock, and she's still been a voice, you know, that I grew up with, seeing as my dad was also a jazz musician here. But, you know, she's got such an irreplaceable voice and such beauty that, you know, still to this day, it's been a part of who I am and probably a lot of musicians.
Do you try and imitate it? Is that possible, Lauren, or just be inspired by it?
Mostly inspired. I don't think anyone could adequately imitate her, but the inspiration definitely, I guess, makes me relate my voice to a more emotional standpoint.
Yeah, it's got to go there. I appreciate your call. Audra McDonald, of course, played Billie Holiday in the Broadway production of Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill, just months before her death in Harlem. Here's a little bit Audra McDonald singing What a Little Moonlight Can Do, a different tempo.
Ooh, what a little moonlight can do. Wait a while till a little moonbeam comes beeping through. You get by, you can't resist him and all you say when you have kissed him is ooh. What a little moonlight can do.
John Sweat, a different sound there. You remind us of Stanley Crouch talking about the double consciousness of African-American singing, assuring, you write, that melancholy can coexist with rhythmic exuberance, sorrow with swing, saying Holiday treated this not as a contradiction but as a means of transcendence. Speak to that, John.
Yeah, I think he's right about that. And, I took some solace in it. This is, again, a question of what interpretations of songs are. I mean, if we begin with the idea that we wouldn't, I suppose, need songs if they said the same thing as speech. I mean, I think I said somewhere in the book, and I can remember quoting myself correctly, that the kind of repetition that occurs in a song at every level, the repetition of rhythm, the repetition of vowels and consonants and the way they work, the poetic repetition, the repeated lines, can only occur in the speech of mad people, children, and lovers. So song is doing something else. It's another kind of message. It's somewhere between prayer and talk, I guess, on one side or the other. So that reactions to it will pick up various parts of this, various parameters of it, various features that strike them. You go home with it in your head, or you don't. It's interesting when I used to think when they were always trying to sue somebody for copying something or sampling something. When we've all sampled them in our heads, we maybe even sing them ourselves, and technically we're violating the law when we do it in front of people. But it's astonishing in the way in which people can make these it's banal to say it, I guess, but make it the soundtrack of their life at some point or another.
It's not hard to do. I mean, you make the point that Billie Holiday at some level knew very well, or certainly had the amazing talent to do this so deeply. You wrote, singers who bravely cross the lines of race, class, nationalism, gender do not merely take on the mannerisms and language of others. They create a way to adapt the musical architecture of songs and their key ideas and reach into a deep structure to make these songs trigger social and emotional responses in everyone who hears them. Was she such an engineer, John?
Hearing it coming from you, I suddenly sound pretentious. I'm trying to say something I really can't find the words for. There's I have no idea what the percentage are, but most, if correct me if somebody knows better, but most popular songs are sad. David Bowie once remarked on that. You can't succeed singing happy songs about yourself or people get bored very fast. Mm-hmm. So there's a long chain of these songs that go way back into 19th century sentimental songs about mother and loss and death. So there's something very special in there that singers who would try to move in and out of other cultures and so forth have to try to adapt to their circumstances and their time. The astonishing thing is that her music still works.
Still triggers those social, emotional mm-hmm. responses in a big, big way. John Sweat is with us. His new book, A Meditation, he calls it, is Billie Holiday, the Musician and the Myth, a really beautifully nuanced, wonderfully written meditation on this great artist. Here's her Good Morning Heartache, 1946. You can join us this hour. What's the feeling Billie Holiday brings up in you? What's your question on Lady Day? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. John, stand by in Philadelphia. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Knew me when, might as well get used to you hanging around. Good morning, heartache. Sit down.
Hi. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
You're just my good for nothing. My sweet hunk of trash.
My, my, how you sound.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The great Billie Holiday behind us right there with, yes, Louis Armstrong, Louis Armstrong. Sweet Hunk of Trash, 1949, a duet there. Louis Armstrong, a great inspiration to Billie Holiday. John Sweat is with us from Philadelphia today, author of the wonderful new book, Billie Holiday, The Musician and the Myth. There had been many biographies written, the famous autobiography, Lady Sings the Blues. He calls this a meditation, both on her life and deeply on her music. You can join us this hour. What do you hear, this great voice, what she is channeling, depicting, sharing? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. What's your question on Lady Day, Billie Holiday? John, let's go to our listeners. A lot have been waiting. Nora in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Nora, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My name's Nora, yes. I'm in my 70s, and I'll never forget the first time I heard Billie. I was living in New York City. I'd just come in on the Greyhound bus, and a friend of mine let me stay in their apartment on the Lower East Side. And I heard her singing on this record, and I was all alone, and I felt alone. And she just, my whole heart just opened to this lady. And I can, like what that man was saying, it's hard to explain what she does to a person and how she made me feel. I just love her, and I still love her, and I'm so glad you have her on today, and I'll definitely get the book. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Nora. It is a beautiful book. It is just beautifully done. They're calling it all back from years ago. Let me get one more right there, if I may. Valerie in New Orleans. Valerie, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi. Valerie from New Orleans. I just wanted to comment that the intellectual interpretations of some of Billie Holiday's songs and as in God Bless the Child,
mm-hmm.
I just wanted to say that I've loved that song for a long time and many of her songs and Billie Holiday. And I feel like it really hit me in the heart, that song from when I was young. But I feel that maybe some people, many people could not fully understand the meaning of that song and others if you haven't been poor. And in the time of Billie Holiday writing this, you know, almost all black people were poor, plus being a woman, so, and being black, and also just when you're poor and you have to rely on people with a greater wealth than you, give a crust and bread and such. And then, it makes me kind of emotional. I went through Katrina, and I've lived in New Orleans for a long time, and I've been poor. I grew up poor, and you could really feel what she's talking about when you've lived those lives.
Valerie, I'm so glad you put it just that way, because I couldn't agree more. I mean, it just comes straight through. You don't have to sit and interpret it very much. If you have felt poverty, if you've lived it, that's going to speak directly to you, and I'm glad you put it just that way, Valerie. John, remind us just how rough Billie Holiday's only childhood in Baltimore was in those terms.
Well, I'll put it this way. After I had access to a legendary book, which actually people weren't aware was sitting in the library, most not completely finished, but largely finished by a woman who did most of the research on Billie Holiday's life, especially the early life, Linda Kuhl, whose untimely death made it impossible to finish the book. But I got into looking at her research and her notes and so forth. And I, frankly, Holiday's life is much worse than we've come to understand. And I was thinking, if someone wanted to write a new biography of her, they're going to have to heap it on even deeper. I mean, it's hard to believe some of the horrors that were involved there. Now,
Describe some of that. Give us a sense of it.
Well, her mother moved her from Baltimore to New York when she was 16, and they moved into a house of prostitution, a fairly famous one in Harlem, where both the mother and the daughter were prostitutes, and the mother was also cleaning the floors. I mean, some of the incidents involving the man who is alleged to be her father and the quest to find him become really painful to read. Her following Clarence Holliday, the accomplished jazz guitarist with the Fletcher Henderson Band and others, around the country was painful stuff to go. I thought, unless you just like pathography for its own sake, this is hard stuff to write, and it's not for me.
She used so many.
I would like to say, though, this stuff does move you, and the trick is that we do know about her biography, and there's a tendency to confuse her discography with her biography, that is, she's singing her own life. Unquestionably, she is in some parts, but she's also singing things that she didn't live. And this takes you into the role of the singer as an actor, which, of course, they are. I guess the only point I want to make about this is that no matter how hard her life was, she was a great artist, and there are a lot of people that had hard lives who can't sing. We don't want to hear their story, even. So it's the art that she brings to this, finally, that really reaches us. Now, it's not to deny that there's anything behind it by any means. It's just that we're hearing a great artist present a story, whether it's hers or someone else's or yours.
Let's listen to one of those stories. It's 1941, famous, sort of slow, grim account of a lost lover, Gloomy Sunday.
Sunday is gloomy. My hours are slumberless. Dear, it's the shadows I live with are numberless. White flowers will never awaken you, not where the black coach of sorrow has taken you.
John Swed, autobiography?
Not in this case. This is a song that's been translated and reworked in several languages, and every time they change it, it changes its meaning. The first one dealt with the rise of fascism in Hungary, and Blood on the Leaves, so it's actually mentioned in there as well. Then it became, in Paul Robeson's version, the dead person from the grave, basically cursing an ex-lover who shows up and pretends that she loved him and said that she dumped him. This is the reverse. This is a song about the person who's left behind talking about and thinking of suicide to join the other person. The song loses its heart at the end, though, when they insert a new phrase that sort of bad movie line about, this was just a dream, I woke up and you're still here beside me and what have you. But there's a curious thing with this song. In his first version that I know of, Artie Shaw recorded it as a swing tune.
Wow.
And it bops along in its own way. And it reminds me that Holliday sang some pretty sad songs that weren't at all sad sounding, such as No Regrets, which is at a walking tempo, and she's saying, well, I've lost this love affair, I've been left behind, so on. Hey, but we learned something from this, and I still got that, and off I go. And you can hear it in Edith Piaf's, her own No Regrets, which is Je ne regrette de rien, where you hear brass bands and drums pounding and they're marching off somewhere. So this is that, back to Crouch's statement, this is the ability to turn a really sad song into something else. There have been people recently who want to read some of the bitterer and tougher songs, such as My Man, which deals with masochism, beating, and so forth. They're embarrassed by these, and they try to find ways to handle them. Barbara Streisand always apologizes for it and gets censored and so forth. But they try to say, well, she's really calling attention to the abuse women take. That's certainly true, but I don't think that's the whole story of that song and what's going on with it or any of those songs.
I just find her so bold in the sort of emotional license here. I can't think of many songs as sad as this. And the artist with the courage just to go all the way to that sadness. Kay in Southfield, Michigan. Kay, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to comment. I grew up listening to Billie Holiday. My dad played a lot of it. And, you know, I didn't really get a sense of her until I began college and read her autobiography at 17. So from her music, I was able to, I guess, connect with Billie Holiday through her life and better understand her music in terms of, I believe from her autobiography, she was born when her mother was 13. And I remember reading at a very young age all of the incidents she had with drugs. So for me in my life, Billie's inflection, her intonations, her musical grasp took on a bit of a cautionary type of a tale for not just women of color, but women in music.
Yeah.
And I always think about people like Amy Winehouse, most recently Janis Joplin.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of what I learned through the combination of Billie's telling her own life story
mm-hmm.
and music and the business of music and drugs.
So watch out, take care.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it gave me an insight and for women, and it's still there, the threats from all sides of being mistreated or taken advantage of. And I just can't help but believe, and I know so many of Billie Holiday's songs by heart, was singing them at a very young age, but Beautiful and Lady in Satin is, I think, that was a release that the critics didn't treat very well because they felt her voice was not what it had been in earlier ages. But I think that that one release, Lady in Satin, pretty much sums up and it conveys through all of her musical acquiescence and embrace everything that her life consisted of, even the cracks in the voice. And there's one release where in the end of it, it's uncut, where you can hear her talking to the musicians. And so much to the heart of Billie. I think that her life story, outside of her music, really doesn't give you a full sense of what Billie Holiday was all about. And I got to say, too, I want to say,
yes,
David Sedaris gives one of the best Billie Holiday interpretations. I mean, he is spot on if you ever catch him doing
it. Yeah, and many people have many mentioning that here, Kay. Kay, I'm so glad you called. Wow, you are really tuned in here and kind of right along John Zwed's line. You mentioned Lady in Satin. This, of course, her last album before she died. Here's a song from it called I'm a Fool to Want You, 1958.
I'm a fool to hold you, such a fool to hold you. To seek a kiss, not mine alone, to share a kiss the devil has known.
To share a kiss the devil has known. John Zwed, what do you think about our caller Kay in Michigan and her hearing a cautionary tale for women in Billie's song?
It's there, no doubt about it. I think, again, the only thing I can say is that a lesser singer would spoil the tale.
Yeah.
I don't mean it literally. It's not saying they're lying or something. It's just that there's a way in which I try to think in terms of actors here. It's a little different than acting and singing, but the point of view you take towards the song is important. Some singers, you sense they're trying to say as they start to sing, now who am I going to be in this song? What role am I taking here?
Mm-hmm.
But I think Holiday is, she said, I have to be able to feel the song. And the key line, which is seldom quoted, but I don't know what to do with it, is she says, there's some songs I just can't bear to sing. I'd love to know what they were. Love for Sale might have been one, which she only recorded once and didn't sing live. And it got banned. But there's that the question of point of view and how are you going to approach the song, and not so much who you are, but where will I be in this? And I tried in my thinking about this to put singers together who had different points of view. And you think of something like I'm in love. I'm losing the song title. Marlene Dietrich's song, Falling in Love Again.
Mm-hmm.
If you listen to her version and then listen to Holiday's, which she would have heard before she recorded it, they're coming in from different planets. Of course, I prefer the Holiday one, but there's a coolness of the
Dietrich
song.
Not so chipper.
Yeah, you have to say, give her some kind of credit. This is really a cool take on the world.
Mm. She collapses in 1959, hospitalized May 31st, signed into the Knickerbocker Hospital under the name Eleonora McKay. Nobody in the hospital, you write, knew who she was. Needle marks on her body, left in the hall for hours. They weren't allowed to treat drug addicts. She was transferred to Metropolitan Hospital in Harlem, treated for heart and liver problems. But because there was heroin found in her room, she's fingerprinted and photographed lying in bed with her finger flowers and possessions taken away, police officers around her there. It's unbearably sad to think of this last moment, and yet she leaves us so much pleasure and what poetic inspiration all these decades later.
You remind me of something I forgot to put in the book, I believe, which was one of the court cases against her was United States versus Billie Holiday. That's the story right there.
Wow.
We complain about the laws and lawmakers in our time, but if you put two and two together on what she encountered, not being allowed to sing in places that sold liquor because she'd used drugs, but you could sing in Central Park or to a group of children, that was okay. Any number of laws about what constituted a violation of propriety, which was, put it this way, policemen who would come into the club to be make sure she wasn't singing, to ask her to sing, or an FBI man who's in her bedroom, hospital room, who's asking her to sign autographs. It's just bizarre.
And yet we all know the pull. John, it's a beautiful book. It's a beautiful meditation. It's been such fun to hear the music and talk with you a little about it. Billie Holiday, The Musician and the Myth by John Swed. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. John Swed, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, and thanks for your good listeners, too.
I've Got My Love to Keep Me Warm, 1955, Billie Holiday. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
The flame grows higher. I will weather the storm. What do I care how much it may stop?